The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good afternoon. Well, it seems odd to speak about our need of peace in one of the wealthiest countries in the world with one of the best social security systems, with a magnificent hospital system, really, and with a pretty good fire brigade system and an ambulance system. And yet, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, as some of you know, Australia is a very anxious people. The highest single psychological problem that we need to deal with, the psychiatric illness, is that of anxiety. Serious anxiety, often teamed up, therefore, with depression. And we just thought we might watch a bit of a documentary here for a few minutes. This is from a British comedy series called Black Books. It's the opening session, and it deals with a character who runs through it. So let's watch this guy as he tries to deal with his stress and anxiety.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you have the little book of calm? I need the little book of calm. Do you have it? I need it. I'm late for work. Calm.
Is this it?
No, it's just too big. Too big. Just small.
This one?
No. Calm. The little book of calm. The little one.
This?
That's the one. Yes.
All right.
Money.
How much? $2.50.
$2.50. I'll
just get you a bag.
No bag. No, I don't need a bag. Just the book. The book.
Or do your receipt.
No, I don't need a receipt. That's fine.
Broken. I'll just write one out.
Please. Look, I'll do it. Oh, calm. $2.50. Thank you. Look, stroke of... No. Let go. Once in a while, you are a loose lily floating down an amber river. Sorry, I hate my job.
What a strange man.
Right. Yeah, it's flying. I'm right on it.
Can we just kill it there? Thank you. It is good fun, the Little Book of Calm. It's actually a real book. I own a copy of it. I bought it second hand. I don't like to encourage writers who write books like that. So I like to buy them, you know, from fates and things like that. But it picks up a real enough issue. It's a send-up, obviously. The people are pretty stressed. They hate their jobs. Their jobs stress them. They're stressed financially. They're stressed in families and relationships or the lack of relationships. And we all, as human beings, seek relief. It's just what we do instinctively. It's an unpleasant experience. It's like pain, and the purpose of it is to make us seek to deal with it. And we deal with it sometimes by hitting the bottle. A comfortably numb is an expression that we use sometimes. Often gambling is a way that people try to tune out. Our holidays are often done in order, we go to comfortable, quiet places. It is, for many people, the beginning of some sort of a spiritual quest. They just think, you know, life is too stressed. Maybe the spiritual things will give me an answer to this. So maybe a visit to the ashram, maybe some meditation. Some sort of answer to this problem we have of stress that really can destroy your life and damage your health. And this is why we're looking at this question of, or one of the reasons we're looking at the question of spirituality. We're looking in a slightly unusual way, although it should be unusual that it's unusual, that is, we're actually looking at what Jesus says. Because so many people in our culture, when they begin to think spiritual, they tend to think of anything other than Jesus. Although if pushed, they'll say, yes, he's one of the great spiritual masters. So we've been looking at this, the biggest single chunk of Jesus' teaching that I'm aware of in any of the four Gospels. John, an eyewitness of Jesus, was actually there at this event at John 13, 14, 15, 16. At the end of chapter 16, Jesus prays for himself and for the disciples and for you. You might like to read a time when Jesus actually prays for you, back there in John 17. We're going to look today particularly to chapter 14 and 16, which is a natural block in the teaching. And it begins and ends with Jesus dealing with the problem of stress, being anxious, being troubled, and peace. He seems to think that he holds the answer to this question of peace. But I want to suggest to you, it's very, very different to the alternatives that our culture will normally throw up. So let's have a look at it, and beginning with what sounds like the negative, but is entirely positive. So firstly, the promise that Jesus gives, and this may relieve you to know, you will have trouble. It's a dead set ironclad promise that the Bible will give us, that you will have troubles. And there it is up there, John 16:33. It's the last thing he says in this conversation with his disciples on the night before he dies. The last statement he makes them before he prays for them is this: I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. So Jesus promises in this, we can miss the promise, not just that he wants us to have peace, but he promises his friends that you will have trouble. This is kind of too obvious to say, isn't it? But we do need to remember that this is just the very nature of life. As Job says, man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. He's just saying it's just the way life goes. And one of the problems with our culture is it somehow or other makes us feel indignant when we hit suffering, as if something abnormal is happening, that life should be easy. Rubbish. Get over it. It won't be. Right? Between now and the time you die, probably in agonizing pain, it will be difficult. Right? That's just... I used to coach these very wealthy young boys in football. Well, they mightn't have felt they were wealthy. Their parents are wealthy. Although they never thought they were wealthy either. The rich never think they're rich. We're all not rich enough. Probably even the Queen worries about her budget. I don't know. But I used to tell them before important games, I'd take them across to a part of the ground and I'd make them throw themselves on the ground where it was hard, and they'd do it softly. I'd say, no, throw yourself on the ground. Smash yourself on the ground. See, it didn't kill you. And the part of the thing was to say to them, you're going to play rugby for 45 minutes or so. It's going to hurt, but it ain't going to do you any harm. It rarely kills you at this level, right? And just expect pain. But don't cry when you get hurt, unless you get something broken, in which case cry your heart out. But just get up and never let the opponent know they've hurt you. It won't. It's a contact sport. I'd say to the boys, if you don't want to get hurt, play chess, where you only symbolically murder people. And so you just got to realize, friends, that life is a contact sport. And fundamentally, life is about dealing with one problem after another problem after another problem after another problem. That's what life's like. Enjoy the green, the good times when you can. But also just recognize you will have trouble. Jesus promises it. And yet simultaneously, Jesus says in that statement, in me you may have peace, in this world you'll have trouble. These two things come together. And the thing that Jesus wants us to learn is that not to escape a life of trouble, but learn how to actually experience increasing peace in the midst of it. This is the secret that Jesus thinks he brings. But he warns us, the Bible warns us, particularly in the book of Jeremiah that I'll quote again later on, that there are always people who are saying peace, peace when there is no peace. There are always people who are happy to try and offer you false peace. And like lots of false medicines, it may seem good at the time. It will often have nasty side effects. So let's have a look at what Jesus says about how to trump or triumph over our troubles. So if you have a look at the very first verse, chapter 14, verse 1. This verse is often read at funerals in Anglican church service. It's not a bad verse, particularly because of the context it goes on with. Listen to what Jesus says. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. He says, don't let your hearts be troubled. Don't let them remain in a state of being troubled. Now, what is this word troubled? Well, it's a very strong word in the original, and it's got the idea of something being picked up or a person being picked up and shaken. So everything is confused and muddled and out of order. And so he's saying, this is what will happen. You will hit troubles. It will cause you to shudder. It will reorganize. It will destroy. You'll be in danger of panicking. It's a strong word. He says, don't let your hearts be troubled. That seems a bit hard, doesn't it? Because how can you help but let your heart be troubled? Things happen. Things are thrown at you. Things upset you. Promises of trouble. Fears and anxieties hit us. And yet Jesus says, don't let it rule you. And we're going to look at what he thinks trumps trouble. What can tame our anxieties? Now, it's interesting to look at this context and think, what is it that's actually caused the disciples to be troubled? Because they're not in a very troubling situation. They're having a nice dinner with Jesus, who has shown himself to be remarkably powerful You got a problem? Bring it to Jesus. He seems to be able to cope with it. Starving to death in the wilderness? He can create bread. Experiencing a bit of death? He can raise people from the dead. Leprosy your problem, is it? Well, he seems to be able to... Right? Crippled, quadriplegic, blind, deaf. He's shown himself more than able to do... You would say, you would think, in the presence of Jesus, having a meal with your friends, with your closest friends, with the disciples, you should be okay. These guys are troubled because of Jesus. He has said a series of things to them just prior to this, at the end of what's recorded in John 13, that has caused the disciples to be troubled. He says to them in chapter 13, verse 21, that there's a betrayer in their ranks that they had not predicted. They had not seen it. They couldn't guess who it was. That's not a nice thing. There's only 13 people in the room, and one of them is a betrayer. In chapter 13, verse 33, Jesus will say this to them. This is actually the cause of the trouble, and he'll come back to this again and again. He says this, "Little children, I'll be with you only a little while longer. You'll look for me, but just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I'm going, you cannot come." So a few verses later, Simon Peter says, "Where are you going?" Jesus says, "Where I'm going, no one can follow me." And so the thing that has caused them great distress is Jesus' promise. He drops this on them in the middle of Jerusalem, "I'm going to leave. In a little while, I'm going. And you won't be able to follow me. You won't be able to find me. I'm gone." And this causes them distress. And if you think about it, why wouldn't it? Grown men. We know many of them had families and wives, etc., who had left their hometown. They'd left where they lived up in Galilee, up in the north. They'd come down to the capital of Jerusalem, which was a center of political power and trouble and turmoil and death often. They'd done that because they were convinced this was the man who held all the answers. This was not just a prophet, this was the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed, the long-awaited king who was going to deal with evil and overthrow the Romans and cleanse the temple and all that sort of stuff. He was going to set things right. So they knew it was a conflict scenario. And they've actually sort of hit the capital city. They're in the middle of sort of enemy territory, as it were, and he says, "I'm leaving." Hang on, what's going on here? That can't happen now. Not now, surely. And he says that they can't follow them. That's why they're anxious. So he will come back to this again and again. If you read John 14, 15, 16, he talks repeatedly about when I go, what's going to happen when I go. "I won't leave you as orphans," he says, because that's how they feel. This is their leader. And this is not a sort of a confederacy of equals, perhaps with one inspiring thinker, but they're all basically equals. This is the Son of God with a bunch of fundamentally peasants, uneducated men, not all that good in the idea of changing the world. That's why they're anxious. They're anxious because there's a betrayer in their midst. They're anxious because their leader is about to go, right at the point that they thought he was going to be the main man. And then he tells them the very last verse, just before this one, where he says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." He says, "Oh, by the way, Peter, who's the two I see, who's the obvious leader amongst them, you're going to disown me. You're going to leave me." So the whole thing is looking pretty grim. So he has said to them things that, although they're in what looks like a nice environment, has caused them great trouble. Then he says, "But don't let your hearts be troubled." It's kind of funny. So he causes the trouble. Then he says, "But you don't need to be troubled." If he hadn't told them those three things, betrayer, "I'm leaving, Peter's about to disown me," they'd have probably been enjoying a nice meal together. But he has actually said the stuff that disturbs them. Nothing in the here and now is troublesome. They've got their food. They've all just had their feet washed, as we saw 2 weeks ago. They're all feeling pretty comfy and cozy. It's Jesus who causes the trouble by telling them what's about to happen. And this is how anxieties and fears normally work. They're normally about stuff that we think might happen. So, in fact, if you go to the doctor and he's done some tests and says, "Oh, you've got cancer," that's not going to kill you here and now. It's fear of the future, right? If your superannuation fund goes broke, that's not going to hurt you today. You'll still be able to buy dinner. It's your future that's concerned. If you hear that they're downsizing lots of people in your area of work, you've still got a job now. It's always the future that makes us anxious. Understand, that's how we work. And Jesus is saying, you don't need to be troubled. Don't let your world be thrown around. He seems to think that he has the answer to this great problem. Well, it's interesting also that he doesn't say, like a sign I saw once in a semi-public toilet that said, "This toilet is broken. Please try not to use it." I mean, you either use it or you don't, I would have thought. I was pleased that it was polite. I thought, what do you mean, "Please try not to use it. I mean, I guess I know. But there are about 10 other toilets you could use there. So Jesus is not saying, please try not to let your hearts be troubled. He's saying, don't let it happen. Now, how can he say that? This is not like that song, Be Happy. That's a really stupid song and can annoy you into unhappiness, because it doesn't give you any reason not to be happy when you're thrown out, you can't pay your rent, etc., etc., etc. It's not like that. It's not like the person who says, don't be sad, don't cry, just because they feel uncomfortable when you're sad. The Bible, when it says, do not fear, which it says very often, always gives you a reason and a logic. It's never just saying, always look on the bright side of life. That's never the message of the Bible, ever. Why shouldn't we let our hearts be troubled? Why shouldn't the disciples be troubled? Well, the answer is odd. He's not going to give a few little aphorisms. Don't sweat the small stuff. Gosh, I hate the title of that book. You know the title of the book? I've not read it. Again, I don't want to encourage him. Don't sweat the small stuff. Next line, it's all small stuff. That's the answer. Trivialize everything is the answer to your problems. Right? I don't know what the book says. I find the title insulting. There are lots of big issues. People dying by the truckload in parts of Africa. That's small stuff? I wouldn't have thought so. All sorts of social and economic problems that people have. Health problems? Small stuff. Acts of violence? That's small stuff. Rubbish. It does help you cope, but it does it by distorting your view of life. It is not what Jesus does ever, by trivializing human suffering. What's he do? Well, the answer's right next to it, isn't it? Do not let your hearts be troubled. Well, what's the answer? Next line. Trust in God. Trust also in me. Now, we can miss just how shocking that is. The Bible is a monotheistic book. That is, it believes that there's only one God. It spends a lot of time trying to convince human beings to not treat God like one of us, because he ain't, and to not give to any one of us what only belongs to God. Trust, ultimate devotion, hope that he is the one who all our great needs will be met. So in Jeremiah, is a classic sort of statement of this, it actually warns very strongly. It says this, cursed is the one who trusts in human beings. It actually says, don't trust humans. I've often had, particularly when I've worked in Anglican churches, and people who make their living, this is going to sound harsh, but there are simply people who make their living begging. In every single case, when I was asked for money as an Anglican minister and tracked down the story was rubbish. Man, and I gave hundreds and hundreds of dollars to people at various times, and I got snipped, which is the word they use, I got snipped by some of the best. It's always better to give and be ripped off than to meet a real case of need and not give. But every single case I ever followed and tracked down, I found out I'd been ripped off. That's okay. I'm still, I've still got clothes to wear, etc. But why am I mentioning that? Well, I can't remember. To be frank, I could bluff and make a segue, but I can't remember where that was going. I may remember later. I'll tell you during the question time. Let's get back on talk, shall we? Now, where was I up to? I need more sleep. Jesus is saying here, trust in... Oh, that's what they say. They often say to me, you're a Christian, aren't you? If I'm being a bit hard, if I'm saying, look, I'll go and buy you some stuff, from food for your clothing. I'll go and buy you a train ticket and make sure you get on the train, because sometimes they'd buy the ticket, then cash it in. They'd say, you're a Christian, you're supposed to trust people. I'd say, wrong. I'm supposed to trust God and love people. Right? And it ain't necessarily loving to help you lie and cheat your way through life. Right? And any money I give to you is money I can't give to someone else. Trust God, love your neighbour, is the basic Bible picture, not trust humans. In fact, the Bible urges you, not a good idea. I will tend to let you down. So what he says here is, when Jesus says trust in God, trust also in me. We can miss the significance of that. He's putting himself in the same category as God. A thing that prophets rightly spend a lot of time telling people not to do. Not to confuse, not to equate. It's just one of the many ones where Jesus puts himself where only God belongs. Trust in God, Jesus is saying. He says, you already trust in God. They're good Jewish boys. He's saying, extend that trust to include me. You do not need to be anxious. Look at what he then goes on to say. He then explains why he's going, the thing that they hate the most. Verse 2, my Father's house has plenty of room. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, so that you also may be where I am. Jesus says, the reason I'm going, the reason I'm apparently deserting you, is to prepare a place for you. He already has a place. He is the Father of the Son. He has an entitlement to the place. You and I don't. Right? We will not be welcomed into the Father's house. We who have not welcomed the Father into our life would hardly expect to be welcomed by him. Right? And that's what the Bible's clear. He goes to prepare a place. He goes to die, to open the door, to throw the door open. If he doesn't go, if the disciples had managed to convince Jesus not to die, they would have locked the door for their only hope of long-term security and being with Jesus Christ. So he says he wants them to understand. So you see, the answer to our troubled hearts is to think. It's not to go and do something where we try and clear our mind and stop thinking. I understand that there's a place for that, to, you know, shut your brain up for a moment at some level. But the fundamental answer, Jesus says, to a troubled and peaceless heart is not to cleanse the mind of thought, which is actually a very, very difficult thing to do, as my friends who've been trying to do it for many decades tell me. But he says, no, he's saying, fill your minds with the truths that will subdue that. True truths, real truths about him and about God. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. And Jesus will outline that it's that sort of faith in him that trumps our troubles and fears. That is what Jesus is saying. Well, let's have a look at this in a bit more detail before we have time for questions. Chapter 14, verse 27. He's just spoken about the Spirit, about that he will send the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, to sort of stand in his place. Then verse 27. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid. Jesus now gets quite overt. He's been saying, don't let your hearts be troubled and all shooken up and panicky. Now he says, I'm going to give you peace, which is the antidote, as it were. This is the sort of thing Jesus will often say at various times. Come to me, all who labour and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. This is the great promise of Jesus. That's why he's called the Prince of Peace. Now, he says, as you saw earlier, Jesus, it's in me that you have peace. See, here's where Jesus is quite different to all the self-help books, and frankly, to some of the spiritual leaders who visit our shores with remarkable regularity, is they'll give you little tips you can take. They're like a walking supermarket shelf. Yeah, I'll try that one. That's not what Jesus says. He doesn't offer something where you can ignore him and not believe in the Father who sent him and find peace. That's just not how it works. He does not offer you any techniques for peace. He offers you a relationship, a person you can trust, a person who knows what is real, and a person who is ultimately loves you and is in charge. And that person secures peace. It's in that trusting relationship, not in some technique. Jesus contrasts the peace that he gives with the world. See, verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. The world, the society we live in, will often offer you various forms of peace. Anxious about things, there'll be an insurance policy you can take out. I'm amazed at the number of different diverse insurance policies that get advertised on the radio. And there should be an insurance policy for all the insurance policies that you haven't got to cover, and for any all the other ones go dodgy. You know, the French had this extraordinarily brilliant defence line against the Germans at the beginning of the Second World War. It was called the Maginot Line, I think it was. I don't know how to say French. It was an extraordinarily brilliant bit of construction, absolutely leading edge of technology. It's what the French had to secure them to give them time when the Germans attacked them again, as they feared they would. They'd lost so many men in the First World War that they didn't have enough for a good army, so they built this huge technological line, except the Germans just went round it. So often the thing you think will defend you doesn't. You've got all sorts of insurances, and something comes up that you can't insure against. Right? And what Jesus is saying, I don't give you peace like the world does. I'm not going to give you diversions, little techniques, deep breathing exercises. You can do those if you like. His peace comes from, the therapy is of thorough facing of reality is what brings peace according to Jesus. It's huge picture peace. So in John 19, you can learn to see the world as it really is, as Jesus sees it. That's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. It means to learn from Jesus. So when Jesus is standing before Pontius Pilate, he is like God on earth in every human sense. Pontius Pilate can decide you're in or you're out, you're alive, you're dead, how you die, how long the torture is going to go for. He was just the embodiment of Roman power. And yet in John 19, you'll see him getting frustrated with Jesus because he won't answer Pilate's questions. He won't defend himself before Pilate. Finally, Pilate loses it and says, "Will you not answer me? Do you not realize I have the power to release you or the power to crucify you?" At which point Jesus needs to teach him. And he says, "You would have no power over me were it not given to you from above." It's just going to drive him crazier. Right, to try and question a man's limited power that we have. We hate our power being questioned. But it's because Jesus sees in the end. Yes, Pilate is the man in power. Pilate is the man who can release him. But Jesus understands that behind that and through that, God himself is at work. Doesn't answer all the questions. But when you begin to see the world in a Jesus-like way and experience his peace, that God works through the darkness often. He'll tell you at the end of chapter 16:33, that remarkable statement at the end of the sort of bit of teaching at the bottom of the page, "Take heart, I've overcome the world." So at the point when it looks as if human society is about to crush Jesus, when the best religion on the world is going to join up with the best government in the world to destroy the best man that ever walked the planet, Jesus says, "Don't worry, I've actually won." He's about to be crucified. And you'll understand if you stay for the next few weeks how it is that Jesus can look so confidently at this. He's saying, end of the story. You want to know how this ends? I win. Even as he is crucified. We have a few little sayings, don't we, in our culture? All's well that ends well, it will end well, Jesus says. He who laughs last, laughs longest. The laughter will be with those who follow him. The world is actually not out of control. The very words that Jesus says in John 13, which seem to upset the disciples so much, "I'm leaving, Judas will betray me, Peter will desert me." Look at what Jesus says here to explain why he says that. Chapter 13, verse 19. He's just told them about the fact that he is about to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. Listen to what Jesus says. "I'm telling you this now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am who I am." So Jesus tells them the disturbing news, so that when the disturbing news happens, they'll go, "Oh, blow me down. He actually was in charge of the whole thing." It wasn't just a world in chaos. He was actually in charge. Jesus will say, "You will all desert me," in chapter 16, verse 33. But he says, "The Father, he is always with me." He will teach us that even when we seem alone, we're not alone. So there's a logic to this. It's not techniques. It's total reality therapy is what Jesus says. Step back. See again the big picture. Stop and think. Don't stop and panic. Stop and think. So Jesus will say in John, in Matthew 6, very similar teaching much earlier in his life. He'll say, "Do not be anxious." Next word, consider. What he wants you to, the answer to anxiety, Jesus says, is to think about reality. To know reality through the teaching of Jesus. That God does work through the dark things. That at the point when Jesus Christ is crucified, what does the death of Jesus say to us? I reckon it probably gives us at least a choice of two things. If someone like Jesus gets murdered, and God seemingly does nothing, and lets someone like Jesus get not just put to death, not just to die accidentally, but to be ritually tortured and humiliated to death, there can be no God that is good. But that is the end of the question. It's over. We are in a dark and pointless universe where evil triumphs. Or maybe Jesus is right. And the death of Jesus is the finest, most beautiful, most wonderful event on the planet. There you'll see how much God loves you. And there you'll see how God can use the evil of humankind, give it his own divine twist to make it the most beautiful deed God ever does, which it is. And which is why Christians happily took an emblem of shame and darkness, the cross, and made it our central symbol. Because that's where you see that God is not only in power, but he's got full of passion and love for us. So the answer to our fears is to learn to think, not techniques. Well, I'll learn to be quiet and leave you some time to ask questions. Well, I'll learn to be quiet sometime. Okay. Man is born to trouble, yes. But is there trouble particularly for followers of Jesus? Well, in John 15, one of the passages that I decided we wouldn't look at, Jesus says to the disciples that if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hates you. And there's a real sense in which becoming Christian increases your troubles, because you're no longer, as it were, floating down the river with the tide. You're now, you know, you're now serving Jesus. And the way Jesus sees it is that fundamentally human society doesn't like him. It's not that he's paranoid, that he was crucified. You don't crucify people who you like. And we follow someone who was crucified, and he wasn't crucified by a bunch of barbarians. It really was human culture and civilization at its best in many ways. And they're not made of different stuff to us, the people who were running Jerusalem at that time. And so in many ways, when you become a disciple of Jesus, you will find life more difficult. I know people who, even at a civilized place like Sydney University, who all, a number of different witnesses, have indicated that the reason why they didn't get the highest positions and become the professor of the departments was because they were Christian. One of the men then went across and became professor of the largest veterinary faculty in Ireland. And then, I won't go through all the details, but yes, sometimes the fact that you're a disciple of Jesus will be held against you. So if you want a trouble-free life, I wouldn't suggest you follow Jesus, but you'll never find a trouble-free life anyhow. That's an illusion. Who is the prince of this world who Jesus speaks about? Who is Jesus referring to as the prince of this world? The devil. The devil is real. He's nothing like the general Hollywood pictures, horns, etc. That's actually the Roman god Pan that people get confused with. The guy with little horns and a fork, that's not the devil at all. There's not a hint in the Bible that he looks like that. And when people say, I can't believe in the devil, of course you can't believe in that ridiculous specimen. But the idea of some sort of angelic spiritual being who at some time before the creation of the world rebelled against God, the Bible consistently, Jesus and all the apostles believe that he's real. And he is called the prince of this world. And at one point, he's called the God of this age. And see, when in John's gospel it speaks of the world, it doesn't, it's not, the way John uses that word, and Jesus in John's gospel, it's not the world like the trees and the dirt and the dust and the water. It's human society, organized in a way to trivialize the true God. Oh, it'll have religion, but it'll be a religion that actually excludes the living and the true God who comes in Jesus. And that's why the consistent history of the prophets of the Old Testament is not that they lead great conquering armies to victory, but that they get put to death. And Jesus is just the highest example of that. And so the Bible will actually say that the God of this world, right, the person who's sort of pulling many of the strings, is the evil one. But what it also says is that behind that and over that, working his purposes out, is the God of all the universe. So that's, and Jesus calls the evil one the prince of this age. What does it look like to practically find peace in Jesus? Good question. And, you know, you'd think after 29 minutes that I spoke for, I should have answered the question, but I obviously haven't. I think the peace that Jesus brings is a struggle. I know some pretty peaceful characters who've gone through periods of suffering the likes of which I've never been through and would never want to. And like the disciples, your heart gets troubled. And then the question is learning to deal with the trouble. In fact, that word troubled is used of Jesus twice in John 12. Jesus says, now is my heart troubled, using the same word. So to have your heart troubled is normal. It's what you do next. It's whether or not it stays in a state of panic. What troubles Jesus is his own execution, where he will go to hell for us. The beautiful thing about Jesus, and you see this in many times, the Bible never makes a point of this, but here is Jesus the night before he gets slaughtered and goes to hell for us. What is his concern in the whole talk? The disciples, who are going to be a bit distressed. Frankly, their distress is nothing compared to his. But he's not trying to get them to comfort him. He's trying to help them learn what peace is. And I think the peace that we have is often the peace in the midst of tears, as the Bible will speak of it, where you'll be in pain, you'll be hurting, but we know God is working things out for good. This is the certainty. We haven't got the faintest clue how God will do it, but we know that he will. This is sometimes taken by people who really have no allegiance to Jesus, and they'll say things like, well, everything happens for a purpose. Well, if that makes you feel good, fine. I can think of all sorts of examples where that doesn't work. That promise that God works all things together for good is, as it says in that verse, for those who love him. If you choose not to walk with God in this, or don't, you know, you can comfort yourself with some of the promises given to those who follow Jesus, but it's just not true. I had a friend who, before she became a Christian, heard that verse. She'd read How to Influence People, How to Make Friends and Influence People, written by a Christian man. And she'd found this verse, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, she didn't believe in Jesus, so she just took the first part, I can do all things. Oh, that's just baloney. She can't. But it made her feel better. You know, that sort of self-talk stuff can help in the short term. It is rubbish, but it can help your morale in the short term. But I think the peace that God brings is a peace which you grow in. You learn, you can actually transform, we learn habits of thought. I've got a number of examples of this is the case where I've learned patterns of thought that aren't helpful. So I always think of my oldest brother and the name of his first wife, but that is not the name of his wife. And if I'm not careful, my brain just goes into automatic pilot and I say, Hewan, and it's not Hewan, it's Hewan. And humans, we learn habits of thought. I've been hanging around God now for 30-odd years, and I think I've just learnt over the years habits of thought. I just know in the end that life's going to hurt, but God will do good things through it. And I just think in the past it was a more deliberate act of disciplining my mind in the light of reality. But then these things become instinctive over time. We just learn patterns of thought. Which is why if you're an anxious person and you hear the Bible say, you know, Jesus saying, do not let your hearts be troubled. Or in Matthew 6, do not be anxious. You know, you should take that seriously. You know, and then I've had friends say, oh, thanks, Ian. Now I not only feel anxious, but now I feel guilty as well because now I'm disobeying Jesus. Well, you know, Jesus is he's a very patient teacher. But I've actually had some people say, oh, listen, I'm just an anxious person. Oh, that's cool. Right? I'm just the kind of person who's into murder. Well, that's a silly thing, right? See, some people say, well, I'm just, you know, if the Bible commands us to go in a direction that we are not likely, you know, some of you are more loving than I am by nature. DNA, family you're brought up, you're just gentler, kinder, more generous by nature. You know people like that. So when they become Christian, it's kind of easier for them to be loving. It's kind of instinctive almost. And the Bible just sort of turbocharges that. Some people are naturally not worriers, some people are worriers. I think what you say, Bill, I'm really not very good at being kind or forgiving or merciful or generous. Well, it's not a question of saying, well, I'm just not good at that. I'll work on something else. No, it's a question of going, I need to get better at this. Right? When I used to play football, I was pretty good with the ball in my hand, but I was not very good at defending. Well, if I wanted to be any good as a footballer, I had to work on my defence. There's no point me saying, no, I just don't defend. Oh, there's another try. Bummer. Right? You have to say, well, I'm pretty good at this, so I need to work on the thing I'm bad at. And I think peace is a learnt thing partly. Learning that more and more instinctively, the God who works through the crucifixion of Jesus, right, can be trusted. A God who loves me enough for his son to die, I can trust him with the small stuff, or the relatively small stuff. The last one's a great question, which I can't answer. Please, can you explain the Father as God, the Son as God, the Holy Spirit as God? No, I can't explain it. Got no doubt at all that it's real. And at the risk of boring people, and I'm only going to be split seconds, I know you've got to get to work, is these things are easier to believe than they used to be. The idea that there is only one God, the Bible is absolutely insane. There is only one God, and yet the poor early Christians, they were dealing, they know there's only one God, they're Jews, for crying out loud. There's one thing the Jews knew, there's only one God. They're the only monotheists on the planet. Had to deal with this guy, Jesus, and they kind of, who is he? What do we make of this bloke? In the end, he keeps putting himself on the category of, you know, who is this man who the wind and the waves obey him? Well, everyone in the Bible knows who controls the wind and the waves. That's God. Who is this one who says, you trust God, trust me? Who is this one who says he's going to judge the living and the dead? Who is this one who says he can resurrect the dead? The Old Testament's very clear. Only God does that. So in the end, there's only one God, but there's a bloke here, the only category that fits him is God, if we're honest. And yet, he's talking to someone. What's going on here? And then he talks about this other person he's going to send who's the Holy Spirit. And in the end, the Christians go, what do we know? There's only one God. What's Jesus? You can pretend he's not God, but it just isn't not honest. So in the end, Father, there's only one God. But it's exactly like that at the level of quantum mechanics we now know. The risk of boring you, light, we've known this for nearly 100 years and we cannot resolve it yet. We might. You can do experiments that prove that light travels by waves. You can do other experiments that prove that light travels by photons, quanta, little bundles of energy like bullets. It cannot be both, but it is. What do you do at that point? No, I don't believe in light. That's stupid. Or you say, it only travels by waves. That's dishonest. You just say, man, the universe is more complicated than we thought. Frankly, if it's true of the universe, why would you think that God would be, as it were, simpler to understand in his ultimate categories than the universe? Can I explain it? No. You can describe it and go, well, how about that, eh? I'll leave it there.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.